You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 222. This must be some kind of hot tub time machine.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer, director, producer, Steve Pink. And Steve is responsible for some of the best movies of the 90s and early 2000s that made you laugh out loud. He is responsible for working on High Fidelity, also Gross Point Blank, Hot Tub Time Machine 1 and 2, Accepted, and his new film, The Wheel, which we'll be talking about in this episode. And Steve and I had a fascinating conversation about Hollywood, about screenwriting, how he got his start in the business, which is very serendipitous to say the least, but how he was able to stay in the business once that door was cracked open for him, all the lessons he's learned along the way, and so, so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my eye-opening conversation with Steve Pink. I'd like to welcome to the show, Steve Pink, man. How you doing, Steve?
Good, man. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. Like I was telling you earlier, but I've been a fan of yours for a while, watching the insanity that is your filmography over the years.
I appreciate that. I do.
With all the love, the insanity with all the love in the world.
Yeah, I mean, for good or ill, I willingly engaged in all the madness, you know, that I chose to engage in. So I can't run from it. I'm responsible.
So first question, brother, how and why did you want to get into this insanity that is the film industry?
Well, I didn't really know it was going to be that insane, although I will say I kind of lived a pretty chaotic life growing up. So it didn't actually feel that insane to me. I grew up with for whatever reason, maybe my social group, maybe my upbringing, a really strong sense of the absurd. Like I thought the world was insane at a very early age, maybe because I had jobs really early. I worked at a bar in the eighth grade as a busboy and dishwasher. I worked Wednesday, Friday, Saturday nights till midnight on Wednesday nights and then till 1 or 2 in the morning on Friday, Saturday. And then by the time I was a sophomore in high school, I was the short order cook and at that same restaurant. So there was a pizza side and a restaurant side. And I did, you know, Italian beef, burgers, chicken, you know, whatever, you know, all, you know, sandwiches, stuff like that. So you know, maybe just my exposure to the world just made me think everything is crazy. Adults are crazy. And so I felt really comfortable, I guess, in the world of chaos. That's the only thing I could really attribute it to. So no, I didn't think it was that insane when I first started. I mean, I do now, of course, but I didn't really know.
I love that. But now, of course, I mean, obviously now I understand. But because we ran away to the circus. I mean, that's the insanity of what we do as filmmakers. We run away.
We're engaged in storytelling. I mean, to me, when you're engaged in storytelling, and the more I do it, the more I've done it, I realize I've been telling stories to myself outside the film industry my whole life. Like we tell, like we, you know, like narrative. It took me a long time to realize that everything was narrative. Like I was like, well, there's real life. And then there's, you know, then there's creating dramatic narrative for film and television or theater or whatever. And then I'm like, wait a minute. It's terrifying to, of course, realize that there is no difference. You're capturing you know, moments in time or characters on journeys to tell stories inside, you know, the dramatic content or a comedy or whatever. And then we as an audience all view it, right? But to pretend like we go home and be like, oh yeah, that's just, you know, that's just the movies and now I'm living in reality separate from that is false, you know? And so once I realized that, it actually made me feel both worse and better, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Sure.
Because that's just what we're engaged in. So if you're engaged in it all the time, it can drive you crazy. Like there are people who are just like, okay, enough. Like you're in a narrative. I get it. Just live your life. Like enjoy your life and live it. And don't, you know, be so analytical and neurotic all the time about everything. But I, you know, I can't help it. So what was I saying? So
exactly, sir. Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So I think being, you know, being engaged in a creative field your whole life is, you know, is an interesting choice. And I love it. And it's caused me all kinds of terrors. But I think that's probably true, to be fair, of everything anyone does in life. You know, like I would never not say that someone who owned a restaurant feels any different.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, I've owned retail before and it's insane. It's an insanity to do any, there's insanity in all levels. It's just that we're one of the most high profile of levels of insanity because everyone sees what we do and consumes much of what we do as well. Now, is there something that you wish someone would have told you at the beginning of your career? If you could go back in time and talk to yourself, what would be the one thing you're like, dude, you know what you really need to look out for? It's this.
Wow, that's a really interesting and good question. You know, if I listen, you know, I said, as I said before we went on, that I'd listened to a few of your podcasts and they're really fascinating and great. And you have great guests. But I should have searched the podcasts, you know, more deeply so that I could have had an answer. I could have borrowed the answer to that question from one of your other guests. Something someone would have said to me that I wish they had told me. That's a really good question.
For me, like if it was me, I answering my own question, patience, man, it's going to take you a lot longer than you think it's ever going to take you to do what you want to do.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I was very, very lucky in the way I got in, but so I didn't feel that as much. And maybe that was a curse in and of itself. I think the other thing is it's way harder. And I heard Ed Zwick talking about this, so maybe that comes to mind. It is way more difficult to actually execute the thing that you want to execute, even when you get the opportunity. So like you have these dreams of doing it, right? And then you even get the opportunity to do it. And then you're in front of it doing it. And then you fail utterly. And you're like, well, wait, you know, I thought that I would, once I got the moment, I'd be able to, because I think it's tricky. There's so many elements to doing something that's good and interesting. You know, when you're on the floor and you have a camera and you have a script and all of your actors, you still have to kind of, you know, be open to, you know, this thing, this magic. And I hate, you know, using that word, but, you know, this magical thing kind of has to happen. Even if you have all the elements, you know, under your control, you still have to create it, you know, create an environment and then get lucky or create an atmosphere and then get lucky where something cool and interesting happens that matches what you had in mind. When you cast it and when you built the set or cast the actors and rehearsed. And so it's that kind of intangible thing. And so I think I took that for granted a little bit. And it's not that I took it for granted. I just was not aware. So if someone said to me, hey, man, you know, be aware, you know, it's going to be so much more difficult the more you do it, not less. Better and better and better. And it's never ending, you know.
Well, it's compromise. That's all we do as directors is compromise. It's like every day, no matter how much money you have, no matter who's in front of the camera, you got to compromise your vision in many ways. And a lot of times it's better than what you ever thought of when you allow that magic to happen. It's when the director wants to control every little thing is when if you hold on too tight, like trying to hold on to water, like it just slips right through your fingers.
Yeah. I mean, art, you know, I'm sure this is probably a cliche someone wrote down somewhere, but art is limitation, right? So you are limited by whatever you are limited by in any given moment. And, you know, money might not be your limitation in that moment. The sun could be your limitation, you know,
right. The location
could be your limitation. Like there's so many different things. And
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, that's why, you know, you I used to be really angry when I'd see, you know, movies that had what would seemingly, well, when you see a movie with seemingly limitless budget, you know, and then it's not good, you have that, you know, you have that,
oh, yeah.
Well, besides the schadenfreude or whatever, you have that feeling, you're like, well, why? Like, right. Was it because you had a lack of limitation? And so you just went, you know, because of that lack of limitation, you weren't critical in terms of like what you needed to tell a good story? Or were you limited by things I didn't even, you know, that are far, you know, beyond me? And those limitations are what kept you from telling a good story, you know, because it's hard to get your head around, you know, when it's $150 or $200 million movie, how it could, you know, not work. And so,
right.
And so I think, yeah, I think it's a constant struggle for all of us at every level. Yeah.
It is frustrating to see a movie that has, and I watch them all the time. You know, you watch something on Netflix and you're like, who gave them money? Like, why? Like, how did that happen? You know, and then you've got.
Well, there's always something, you know, is the reason, right? You can say, oh, well, because of this or because of
that. It was the actor. It was the location. It was the executives. This, you know, the script was, you know, they had to rush it to get it out before. There's a thousand things that could happen, but it's still frustrating when you see something like that, especially when you're in the business and you're like, well, and then, of course, in the back of every director's head, we're like, well, we could have done better than that.
Well, I also think like, yeah, I mean, I also think like, you know, I would try my damnedest to do better if I had all the resources, right? I mean, I don't really think, hey, I could have done that better as much as I think like, I was like, boy, you know, I would have liked the shot to be on the floor instead of you. You know, like, I don't know if I could have done it better, but shit, I couldn't have done it worse.
Right, exactly. And it's fascinating because, I mean, I've had the pleasure of talking to some directors who have, you know, worked in those $200 million, $150 million budgets. And I always ask them, I'm like, what's it like, you know, working in that environment where you've got like the biggest movie stars in the world and anything you want? Like, I remember when I was coming up in high school, True Lies was shooting in Miami. And, you know, Jim Cameron was already Jim Cameron at that point. And I went on the set. I was, you know, just hanging out, not on the set, but like, you know, outskirts of the set. And I just remember seeing that Jim had every toy you can imagine sitting there. Techno, Steady, helicopter, everything, just in case he wanted it. Not like I need the Techno for the day. No, 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 no. The Techno was there the entire shoot in case something, he gets tickled to do a Techno shot. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you know, looking at his work, you're like, yes, you deserve to have everything at your disposal.
Absolutely.
Like, for sure.
I mean, sure. Just every brush do you want, sir, you should have. Chris Nolan, David Fincher, these kind of filmmakers, they need what, give them what they want.
And I bet they're also very good at planning. You know, like the more they dial in that which they're going to do, all of their shots are so planned and they're so smart about what they're doing that, you know, that you're not just deciding to, you know, put a camera in the helicopter like spontaneously. And maybe even they have the opportunity to do that, but it's beyond all their planning for sure. You know,
without question. Now you mentioned that you kind of had a break early on. What was that first big break for you?
Well, I was very lucky because so I met John Cusack in high school because we became friends, but we became friends through a student run comedy variety show that was kind of like, it still runs today. It's like a very famous, like, you know, it's one of those, you know, 50 year running variety shows that they do every year that the students run. And I applied to be the writer director my senior year. And so did John, and so did two other guys. And so then we found ourselves, you know, the summer before our senior year writing the show together. And that's how we became friends. And then.
John was already John. I mean, he was already, he's acting already. He was already a star. I mean, quote unquote, a star in the 80s star already. He already done Better Off Dead and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, but he had done Better. Nah, I don't know if he had done Better Off Dead, actually.
Not yet, but he'd been working. He'd already been working.
Oh, yeah, he did the shirt. He had done, I think he was just doing the shirt thing. He had done Class, I believe. I think Class had come out. But, you know, it's interesting. I went to a huge public high school. We had like almost 4,000 kids. And there were so many there were so many high flyers in all these different categories that it actually John wasn't, obviously he was famous and he got a lot of attention for being, this young actor who might be a movie star. But, it was just a very competitive public high school. So it never really felt like out of proportion. Like there were plenty, oh yeah, John's the really cool actor. It's like, oh, there's the guy who's going to the MBA. There's, there's our class valedictorian is going to Harvard, and she's, going to do great things. One of our closest friends went on to be nominated for a Pulitzer in journalism. She was already running the school newspaper. Wow. And then went to Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern. Like there were just so many from our perspective, there's so many people doing so many amazing
things. So he was one of many very cool people.
Yeah, it all seemed to balance out. There was 900, I think, in our graduating class. And there's at least, maybe 150 or 200 people that I think was like this community of ours. We were all doing so, really cool. And I feel like everyone's doing really cool things. But in any case, we, full of ourselves, obviously. Over the years while I was going to college, Johnny started working with Tim Robbins in a theater company called The Actors Gang. Then I went and did a show with the Actors Gang in between, in the summers between going to school. And I actually got replaced by Jack Black for a show in 1980. I'm dating myself, in the late 80s, because I had to go back to Berkeley and the show extended. So then Jack took over my part, which I only had 12 lines and I moved a lot of scenery, frankly. But anyway. It's true. And then Johnny and I formed a theater company with a bunch of other actors called New Crime Productions. And I was a social worker, actually, I was an outreach caseworker for the homeless, mentally ill. That was my job after college. And Johnny had gone out to L.A. And I was running the theater company and working as a social worker. And he had got a producing deal. Brandon Tartikoff, who was a legendary network chief, went on to run Paramount Pictures. He gave John a producing deal. Then John asked me to run the company with him. And so that's how I got my start. So I was extremely.
So it's a story that everyone goes to that. I mean, that's it's the obvious story. I mean, I too became good friends with Brad Pitt and I've been working with Brad for years now.
Yeah, it's a lucky and ridiculous event to have happened to me to walk.
That's amazing.
The door. It was amazing. And then, I was very, very lucky. And then we were still tasked with doing something good. And that
there's that
one challenge. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had to actually, and I felt the pressure of that, too. We were young men and I started to run his company and it was challenging to get to know the business from that vantage point. And then try and create something with John that stood out and would be something that we wanted that stood out as the kind of movie and stories we wanted to tell and do. And that's a challenge, especially since, we walk to have the opportunity to walk through that door is just it's just beyond extraordinary. So once you start talking about, well, it was hard once we got in, anyone listening is like, yeah, well, you just had like this golden ticket. So how hard was it? Yeah. It's hard to it's hard to kind of that is true. But then because you have to do something good and you have to contend with the industry and actually get movies made and try and do it, I felt like it's square one anyway.
Right, exactly. And and because I've been able to talk to so many of these filmmakers who've had these kind of lottery ticket moments, I mean, you had kind of a long lottery ticket moment with, meeting, just happened to become friends with John Cusack at the time of his career when this was all going on, and you guys gelled and it worked. But then you got people like Kevin Smith or Robert Rodriguez or Ed Burns or any of these guys. And the one thing I've always discovered talking to all these guys is that you might have been lucky getting in the door. Right place, right time, right movie, right situation. There's a lot of those kind of stories through Hollywood. But staying in the door is where the work starts. So yeah, you might have had a little bit of an opening. But man, it's not easy staying in that room. You could get invited in that room, but you could have easily just been like, and security. Very easily.
Yeah. I mean, the door opens, as the door opens and closes, and you have to keep prying it open. I think that, there's very few filmmakers, even legendary ones, who have like whole palaces of doors open for them. I still wake up in the morning with, a crowbar ready to pry a door open.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Absolutely.
I think that's just what we do. And it's just the nature of it. And so that's true of me for sure. And it continues to this day. That can be my segue to The Wheel.
We're going to get to your new movie, The Wheel. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, well, we can talk about that later, but like, that's another example of something. And when we get to it, that it was like, oh, I see an opportunity to do something and to explore something that I haven't had the opportunity to do. And, you know, when you go down that road, it's just like anything else, you know, you continue to want to work and try and make something good. And that's what we do for a living.
So, I mean, you were obviously involved with one of my favorite movies of the 90s, Gross Point Blank. It is such an insane idea. You know, a hitman goes back to his high school reunion and he's having issues. And it was such a brilliant film. How did you, is that something that came from you and John? How did that whole, because it, like I tell people, that movie would never get made today. Just wouldn't get made today in the studio system. It'd be very difficult.
Yeah, although it would be made in television, right? You know, like
could be a series. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Barry has some, you know, it is reminiscent in a great, and they've like taken off and done, like if I could have made the series, if there was more stories around that, I mean, but those guys did an extraordinary, you know, that I love that show so much.
Oh, it's so
I love
good.
It
so
because
good.
Of things it reminds me of from my first movie. And then all the things they've done to explore that concept is so brilliant and so fun. And I love it so much. I just have to say, it sounds horrible that I'm saying this because it sounds like, oh, great, I thought of Barry, which is not the case. Like I stole all kinds of things to make Gross Point Blank happen, right? Like The President's Analyst, which is this quirky, weird 70s movie about, I think these bad guys trying to kill the psychiatrist of the president, I believe, although it's been so many years. Like there were all kinds of movies like that that I loved and influenced me. Mm-hmm. And so by no means am I saying, and I don't even know if I influenced them in any way. It's just we share a similar idea. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to be kind of misconstrued as
Hard, but how did that come to be?
Oh, so we got this deal at Paramount, and then we would get, you know, submissions in, and I didn't even know that you weren't supposed to read unsolicited material. I didn't know the distinction. You know, I guess the answer to your earlier question, which is, you know, what do you wish someone would have told me prior to getting into Hollywood? And I guess the answer would have been, well, everything about producing, because I didn't know anything. No one told me anything. I was just suddenly sitting in an office in Paramount. I mean, I at Paramount Pictures, and I was trying to like figure out like what would be the process of thinking of an idea or creating an idea and then, you know, getting it, you know, made into a movie. And so I got this script. It was written by this guy, Tom Jankiewicz. It was unsolicited, you know. You know, that's the other thing, like, you know, companies don't take unsolicited material because they're afraid they'll be sued if people steal their ideas, et cetera. And I was like, well, they could sue me. I'm a social worker, you know, like 6 weeks earlier, I was was making $17,000 a year. So, you know, mm-hmm. be your worst. But that's just a joke. I wasn't actually even thinking about it in those terms. I simply didn't know. So I read the script and it's really amazing. It's kind of a straightforward actioner. I meet with and it strikes me as like a brilliantly and beautifully ironic idea and funny. So I talked to Tom Jankiewicz about it. He, you know, he was okay with DVD Vincentis, who became my for a long time writing partner. And we just had kind of a vision for the movie that Tom didn't necessarily share. He wasn't against it, but he was just kind of like, you know, I wrote the movie I wrote, but if you guys want to revise it, go ahead. So we said, great. So we came out. So we, you know, started figuring out like how to, where our approach was to kind of subvert all the expectations of the movie. So like, for instance, in Tom Jankiewicz's version, there was the bully he goes back and see, but in the bully version, there's like a big fight, right? And he fights the bully and wins. And we thought to ourselves, well, you know, the bully isn't your enemy anymore. He's probably, as an assassin, going to have real enemies. And so, like, what is the subversion of expectation with the bully? And that is that he's not this scary, terrible person who tormented you in high school. And in this case, he's a sad drunk who writes poetry, right? So, you know, the father who would be angry that he left his, you know, that he left his daughter, that John's character left his daughter, you know, standing in the doorway and never having picked her up for prom, he would be angry, right? Well, no, because he's a corrupt corporate raider of a certain kind. And so he has an affinity with John Cusack's character because they're both men of the world who are corrupted by that world and therefore share a bond. And so it was kind of all these little kind of tropes or touchstones that we looked at and wanted to mess with. And, you know, we were fortunate enough. It was actually the movie was originally after we revised it and took it to market. It was first bought by John Calley, who was a famous filmmaker or studio boss who had made, you know, Kubrick's movies. And he was kind of it was yet another version of the United Artists MGM, like being reconstituted at that time. Right. So United Artists was becoming an active studio again, and John Calley was running it. He was the one who originally bought the movie. And that was, you know, just amazing that he bought the movie and saw its potential. And then it ended up getting turned around. He ended up not being able to make it and was so gracious about giving it back to us. That's another thing, you know, just that's another piece of luck. Yeah, like you don't, you know, my career is just a series of lucky moments in which, you know, and maybe that's true of so many of us. But so John Calley couldn't make the movie and he was really gracious about giving back to us, which is, I didn't know, not a thing. Like my attitude was, oh yeah, well, great. If you can't make the movie, then we get to go make it. Yeah, we get to go make it somewhere else. It was only later that I found out that that's not actually a thing. And his generosity was extraordinary. So he gave us the movie back. I'm not sure. So Joe Roth and Roger Birnbaum, who had a kind of mini, they had a huge producing company called Caravan. And they ended up taking on the movie. And Donna Roth, Joe's wife, and Susan Arnold were the producers. And so it was actually Donna and Susan who brought it to Roger and Joe, and Roger and Joe agreed to make the movie. And so that's how it happened. So it was, again, a series of kind of lucky things that fell our way.
That movie, if I remember correctly, was a fairly decent hit. I mean, it wasn't a blockbuster monster hit, but it was a decent hit enough that the town would, you know, it's like, oh, these guys are doing some cool stuff.
Yeah, I think I remember, I could be wrong about this, I'd have to ask my colleagues, but I believe that it got really good long lead press. And so they gave it a slightly better release, I think, or much better release. I think that it was going to be released maybe. And again, I didn't really know anything about these kinds of things. I just remember hearing that it was our release was pushed and it was because of the long lead press. So I'm now repeating that story, you know, 25 years later. But so then it was like, then we knew that maybe we had something, you know, that was maybe good and that maybe people would go see. So, yeah, I think it did well, although it was really funny because, you know, I think Anaconda came out.
It was 97. So, yeah.
Weekend, and I think we got crushed. And I remember thinking.
Well, J-Lo, yeah, I mean, it was J-Lo, man.
J-Lo was amazing. 97. I think I went and saw that. I'm sure I went and saw that movie that weekend or the weekend after because it was in the same theater. I think we got crushed by Anaconda. And I was like, well, yeah, that movie's awesome.
I'm thinking, is this pre-Con Air or post-Con Air?
This was the first movie. Gross Point Blank was kind of the first movie that we did together. And it was definitely the first movie that John Cusack had a gun in his hand. And that was part of a thing that we discussed actually before, before the Gross Point Blank came along. And this might sound silly, but we did discuss things like, well, so at that time, there were a lot of John had a lot of opportunities to play an FBI agent or play a cop or whatever. Basically, you know, all these ideas that would put a gun in his hand. We just kept saying we had this line where we were like, well, if you're going to have a gun in your hand, you should have a gun in your hand, ironically. And we didn't exactly know what that meant, you know, but we were like, yeah, because we don't necessarily want you to be a hero with a gun. Like we were just kind of fundamentally against that. We didn't know what that creatively did for him, you know, like what is that for you as an actor and as the kind of characters you play, like how does that work exactly? And so, you know, to be an assassin and a kind of anti-hero made absolute sense, right? Because then he could be.
Well, he's perfect.
Because he could question his very existence, and his existence is killing people with guns. And so I was like, oh, well, that makes perfect sense.
Right, exactly. Now, after that, you did another movie, another classic 90s film, High Fidelity.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Where, I mean, it's, you know, the cast in that is, I was looking at the trailer the other day. I was like, Jesus, man, you had everybody in that movie. It was insane. And then I realized who the director was.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how in God's green earth did the guy who did Dangerous Liaisons end up doing High Fidelity? So what was it like working with Stephen Frears, who is this legendary filmmaker, and what were some lessons that you picked up from him?
Well, that's a great question. Well, we got Stephen Frears because John had made a movie with him.
Right.
So again, you know, this is going to become an unbearable podcast because it was just another lucky moment in our lives.
Right, let's just state this right now. You are a very, yeah. Did you buy a lottery ticket for the Powerball? Please, yeah. Just buy one. Buy just one. You only need the one.
Yeah, I bought the cinema lottery ticket and it,
it keeps paying off. Annoying.
Yeah, because Joe Roth, after Gross Point Blank, became the chairman of Disney, and he had High Fidelity under the Touchstone banner, and he gave us the book. He said, hey, you guys, what do you think of this book and what do you think about it as a movie? And it was extraordinary. And, you know, we wrote a script that he liked, Joe, I mean, and he said, go find a director. And
we go get Stephen Frears.
And Johnny called Stephen Frears, and Stephen Frears said that he would do it. So, like, okay, this is terrible. We can end this podcast at any point. I mean, I have struggled quite a bit in my career. And so if we have another 7 hours, we can talk about the actual, you know.
I'm hitting the highlights here. I'm hitting the highlights. If you want, I can go into the bombs if you'd like.
Yeah, we can get into the things that didn't work. We can get into my struggles over the years. Like, that would be, I think, at least helpful to balance out this podcast. But just to finish this high point before it all went south, we brought Stephen Frears, and then we went through a script process with Stephen that was almost a year in length, 6 to 9 months. I think we rewrote the movie a bunch of times, and I learned, you know, and then watching him work was just extraordinary. You just learn so much, but I learned so many extraordinary things from him. You know, like, he would talk about, and I was constantly interviewing him, you know, off the set, and because I just wanted to learn, and he would always indulge my questions. And, you know, I would ask him, you know, really pretentious film school questions, like, what is style? You know, I was like, what is style? Like, what, you know, like, you see if Scorsese has a style and Tarantino has a style, and, you know, and he's done so many styles, which is why I asked him, because if you look at Prick Up Your Ears or The Hit or Dangerous Liaisons,
The Queen,
or The Queen, or even High Fidelity, pretty much every movie he makes, Dirty Pretty Things, has a different style. You know, he's kind of a master wizard of it. And his, you know, he thinks, and, you know, this is just his opinion, and it's just a really interesting perspective, true or not true, or you can evaluate it's, you know, whether it's true or not, or, you know, what it means. But he said that there is no such thing as style in his mind. He's like, a director utilizes what he needs and makes at his disposal what he needs to tell the story he's telling. So if he needs to fly the camera, you know, through a building, you know, to, you know, like, you know, if he needs to, you know, whatever, use very, whatever style he's employing, you know, with the camera, whether it's to lay back and not have the camera be intentional and you don't really notice the camera, or whether the camera is like this, you know, crazy flying creature that is part of the storytelling. He's like, that is what the director needed to tell his story. Right. So because of that, then you say afterwards, well, the director made a film and it looks like this Edgar Wright or Martin Scorsese or David Fincher. And you go, oh, well, you know, he employed this style as a director to tell this story. And Stephen Frears would say, no, he told the story the way he needed to tell the story to make it work. And the style comes after. You look at it and say, oh, well, that is the style he employed. But Stephen Frears would say, and maybe he would disagree with him, maybe he would have a different view this many years later. I haven't talked to Stephen in many years. But then he said to me, that's how he views it. And so the instructive thing to me about that was, okay, well, then I don't You know, when I'm looking at shooting any given thing, I'm like, well, how do I tell the story of this moment, or how to tell the story of this? What is the story of this particular shot? What story am I telling in this particular moment? I know that I have all kinds of stylistic choices available to me without getting caught up in saying like, oh, well, I can employ this style, but not that style. Like, what do I need to tell the story most effectively?
Well, I mean, you just have to look at someone like Kubrick, who was literally the master of changing genre. I mean, he literally made the movie of every genre.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to make the comedy. I'm going to make the war movie. I'm going to make the horror movie. I'm like, and you just look at his style, and there's certain things that kind of there's things as far as flavors that you can kind of see throughout his projects. But the stuff that he employed in Dr. Strangelove is not what he did in Eyes Wide Shut. Like, a completely different. It's what he needed to do to tell those individual stories. So that's really interesting. That's an interesting. I mean, I completely agree with Steven on that one.
Yeah, I agree too. And you can see it in their work. Like, you know, I love Jane Campion, and when, you know, mm-hmm. Power of the Dog is a movie I just love. But I also loved Sweetie and Angel at My Table back in the day, and I'd forgotten how concerned she is with the interior lives of her characters. You know, she'll stop everything all the time to
The piano. Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the piano. So like really just be in a really urgent observational state, which I am just amazed by. Like because it's observational, but it has this urgency, which I find kind of astounding. And that's a wholly different style because the camera isn't moving, you know, it's not moving that much. But yet she achieves that, and it's really cool.
So then so after you've had some successes and you've been doing some stuff, and then you get a chance to direct your first feature film with a fairly decent budget. It's a studio budget, you know, where, you know, this is not $200 million, but this is the first time you're on set running a big, you know, studio production. So what was it like in the movie, by the way, is Accepted, which I just adore that movie. I thought it was so much fun to watch that film when it came out. And again, stupid cast, like insane cast that you had back then. What was it like walking on the set the first day on your first studio project? Like, are you waiting for security to take you off?
Yeah, I mean, I got this like pain in my shoulder that was so was so sharp that I had to like take a bath like after the shoot day. Like I was like, I had to figure out how to loosen up my shoulder. I was so stressed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My shoulder was just killing.
Kicked it up all day.
I was working so hard to like have a successful day that.
Make your day. Just make your day in general.
Make my day, do something interesting, you know, make it, you know, like create, you know, creating comedy. I always felt fairly comfortable with actors because I directed a lot of theater. So I was always pretty comfortable directing and rehearsing and blocking, right? I could gin up at least something, you know, gin up enough really interesting and funny stuff. And with great actors, it's not, you know, it's something that I love, and it's something I feel that I'm halfway decent at. So that part was the part that I understood. But then capturing it with the camera, you know, was just a wholly different thing, because I had to learn very quickly, you know, how to get what I was just rehearsing in the camera in the same way I just pictured it in real time, right? With the naked eye, like, okay, so it's really, really funny to me, but it's not a play. So how do I keep everything that's really funny and spontaneous about that, that I just rehearsed, and how do I shoot it so that it still feels spontaneous and funny when we shoot it? And that was a learning process that both Universal and Tom Shadyac, the producer, were really, really patient with me in terms of discovering. It also was a little bit hard, I will say, after all these years, that the movie really wanted to be an R-rated movie. You know, it's a guy who starts his own college, right? So the fact that we could never,
there was no American Pie moments. There was no American Pie moments.
There was no sex, no drugs, no outrageousness of that, you know, ilk and of that order. And so it made it a little bit harder. So I was like, well, how do I create a kind of, call it edgy lunacy, you know, given
without the going there, right?
Yeah, and we did. We found some things, you know, like they let us get away with the fact that the kids, since they're trying to whatever, they're going to renovate a mental hospital and turn it into a college. And they found like, the electroshock therapy machine you know, so they're like shocking each other and drinking what looked like, you know, alcoholic drinks, you know, the things like that, that I kind of got away with that seemed funny because I didn't have anything else at my disposal. But, you know, the actors were also incredibly funny and warm and cool.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And that, of course, is what, you know, really made it work, you know, most of the time. You know, no. They're letting me blow up a car. Like, it's a totally absurd. It's a total. It's a grounded based film. It's a, it, the film is, has a grounded reality to it. But somehow at the very end of the movie, you know, the character whose dream is to be, you know, believes he has like telekinetic powers, you know, blows up a car in his mind. You know, he succeeds in his life goal at college. And the fact that they let us put that in the movie and keep it in the movie was, you know, just funny and, you know, ridiculous.
So, you know, as directors, you know, there's always that day on set, if not every day, but there's that one day that really everything is falling apart, whether you're losing the sun, you're like the camera truck crashed along the way and you've lost your camera, actors won't come out of something, whatever it is. What was that for you on this project on Accepted? And how did you overcome that overwhelming thing, that feeling that you feel like the entire world is coming crashing down on you?
Let's see. What day was that?
I know every day. Like I said at the beginning, it's every day. But there must have been one day that was really just like, Jesus. Or one day that you remember that you were just like, you know what? This day. Oh.
Well, there was a day. There was a day where we were shooting the scene where the parents show up. Justin Long's parents show up and they have to kind of, he has to give them a tour, and we were rehearsing and I realized I didn't have enough jokes. Like there wasn't anything funny going on per se. Like they kind of walked down the hall and the dialogue was the dialogue, but I was like, like this doesn't seem like and it was something we probably should have planned for, but I was like, wait, shouldn't they be hiding something? Shouldn't they? Like, what's the dance that's happening around the parents that just ends up out of frame, or that they don't see when they turn the corner? And like, what are the things they're trying to hide, and what are the things they're trying to present as the real school? And we had to kind of just, so that panicked me, because I was looking at a whole day of shooting that was not going to be funny. And it was a really important scene in the movie. And so with the help of, you know, the producers and the actors, and every department, that was one of the first times I was like, well, what do props have? What does the production designer, what do we have in terms of the art department? Like, what things can we generate? What things would be funny? And I think it's a pretty funny sequence. Had we really, really planned it the like I would today, it would be, you know, 10 times the size. But so then we managed to, like, you know, of course, because of Justin and him being so funny and being really, really good at being the kind of like, you know, he was the one who was like, you know, had all the ball. He was juggling. He had all the ball. He kept the balls up in the air. Right. So he was really, really good at playing that tension. And so we made a sequence out of it. And I think it worked out OK. And it's a funny little sequence. But that was the first day I realized that there will be times where you arrive on set thinking everything's great and nothing's going to work in terms of like what you're about to shoot. And you
pretty much almost every day.
Yeah. And you have to figure out, like, you know, and so I never. So from that moment, I've never taken for granted that something you think that I tend to worry about the scenes that I think are going to go well. Like the scenes when I'm planning a shoot, the scenes that, you know, seem the big set pieces and the big shoots, whether they're big parties or big hijinks or stunts or whatever it is. Those get planned so much and you work on them so much that even though there's, you know, whatever, a nervousness around executing them well. An attendant amount of worry goes into that. I'm always keeping an eye out for the ones that sneak up on you. The one that you think, oh, well, we're going to shoot this in 2 hours. It's a really funny scene. Everybody gets it. We know what story we're telling. We know the actors know what they're doing. This thing's going to be no problem. We're going to be out of it by before lunch. And then we'll be getting on the rest of the day. Those are the ones that I worry most about, or I don't know if I'd say worry is the right word. Those are the ones that I pay attention to.
Cautious. You're cautious about
them. Yeah. I pay attention to them. I spend extra energy around making sure those scenes will actually work, because those are the ones that if they suddenly don't work, surprise you. And then, you know, you don't want that.
Now, you also had a small producing gig with a small young actor named Tom Cruise a few years ago as well. You were one of the producers on his film Night and Day with Cameron, and it was Cameron, if you ever remember, Cameron Diaz and him. When you were a producer on that, that's now you're at a whole other level, budget wise and things. Is there any big lessons you learned from producing a film like that?
Well, this would be a no fun story, but I actually didn't work on the film. So what happened was it was an idea that I came up with Todd Garner, the producer, and a great friend of mine, Patrick O'Neill, who's a great writer, wrote it. And we sold it to Revolution Studios that Joe Roth was running. And at that time, I was attached to produce with Todd, and we were going to make the movie. And then it got turned around to Fox, and it had a very, you know, crazy journey, like so many movies do, to getting made. And this one ended extraordinarily with you know, James Mangold and right. Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. But by that point, even Joe Roth and Garner weren't actively producing it. Like I think James Mangold had his producing partner, and so we weren't active participants in the making of the film.
Got it.
But I was an active participant in having, you know, and obviously coming in with the idea, having it written, and then, you know, kind of, you know, trying to get it made for years. So, but by that time, by the time it came around, it wasn't our film anymore. And I have extraordinary credits on that movie. because Joe Roth gave me those credits, right? It was a movie that I thought of, that I pitched him, that I had written yet. That, you know, I have a presentation credit. It was going to be my company that produced it, and I was going to be the producer. It's just that it, you know, it got away from me in all these different ways. And you know, it happened so often, you know, like, I don't know what I would have contributed anyway. Like, I would have liked to have been a part of it, but I'm not sure at that point that anyone was interested in my opinion about the film, you know, like. I would have loved to contribute to the movie, but who would have listened to me, frankly?
But it's a juggernaut at that point. It's literally just this giant machine that's moving forward. And, you know, when you have someone like Tom Cruise and even James Mangold back then, he wasn't James Mangold of today, but he's still a very, you know, sure. very, very strong director. That machine is going. It's hard to jump on.
They certainly didn't need me. I should say this way, creatively, I think they needed me. I mean, I love the movie, but there was certain, like, there's some DNA in there that that inspired the idea to begin with, that I wish they had preserved, you know, like, but that's me looking at it. Like, the movie stands on its own and is funny and great in its own way. So it doesn't necessarily need the things I think it needed. But of course I have a desire, you know, like in my, you know, this happens to everyone who's made a film or watches a film get made. You think, I wish it had contained these other things that I had in mind, you know, but whether they actually needed those things or not, I don't know. But I thought it was really fun. I thought Tom Cruise did amazing.
It was unlike his normal films.
The whole idea was hero as unreliable narrator.
Right, exactly.
It was hero as unreliable narrator of reality, you know.
Now, the one thing when you came across my desk to come on the show, the one question I knew I was going to ask you, and I've actually been dying to ask you this before we even knew that you were going to come on the show, because when this came out into the world, I was like, how on God's green earth did this happen? Hot tub time machine, sir. How did this get birth into the world?
Well, you first have to ask Josh Heald, and you should have him on the show. He's the creator of Cobra Kai now. You should definitely have him on the show. He thought of the idea. He might have even thought of the idea in a hot tub. I'm not sure.
By the way, he's absolutely brilliant, and what they're doing with Cobra Kai, I'm obsessed with Cobra Kai. With it.
It's amazing. And he wrote the movie. He set it up with Luke Ryan, who's an executive at MGM. And Mary Parent was running the studio at that time with an executive named Cale Boyder. And they were just crazy enough to make it.
I was about to say, like, this is the weirdest pitch it's like so weird. It crosses over like, yeah, maybe it can work.
Yeah. I mean, they were, you know, Kale and Mary and Luke were game. They were great. And they understood the movie. They were like, this is totally ridiculous and funny. And you know, at its core, because they're also smart filmmakers, they understood that it was a midlife crisis movie.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Right. It's a midlife crisis movie. But instead of like going to a dude ranch or going on a motorcycle like tour, they go into a hot tub time machine and have to relive their past. Right. So the thematic ideas are the same. It's just that the engine or the journey through, you know, that they take to explore those same themes is totally bonkers. You know, it's they go through a hot tub.
So instead of city slickers or old dogs, you've got hot tub machine.
Yeah, which and so then it was like all separate. Then it was very self-referential, right? We were all the characters, the filmmakers, the audience. I think everyone, there was something about that movie where everyone understands that they are self-aware about the fact that it's totally bonkers. Like the notion of it itself is so ridiculous that everyone's invited to the party once they acknowledge that's the case. And so when you're the filmmaker or you're the audience or even the characters themselves, you're all enjoying the same thing, right?
Right. Like,
no one's going to take this seriously, right? I mean
it's called hot tub time machine.
Yeah, they go back in time in a hot tub. Like what? Yeah, it's like in every, just what you, the, even the way you just said it is just right. Like, makes the whole thing worthwhile, I think. And so,
right. The thing that's brilliant about it is that it's so absurd that if you can't get past the title, you won't enjoy the movie. But if you can get past the title, then you, and you're in on the joke, then you're just on for the ride. And that's exactly what that's the brilliance of Hot Tub Time Machine. I mean, as I say it, it sounds ridiculous. Well,
and I have to say, it was really courageous of Mary and Kale to not change the title. You know, like there, we got a whole list of titles. It wasn't really? Like they didn't consider it. Oh, yeah, we got a whole list of titles to consider because exactly what you said was exactly the case. Like when polled, right, they do all the market testing or whatever. And when you ask the question, would you ever see a movie called Hot Tub Time Machine? Well, I mean, the answer is obviously no. Like, right. You're not going to see a movie called Hot Tub Time Machine. But then when they show them Hot Tub Time Machine along with the materials, the trailer, the tone, the fact that it was an ironic title in that sense, then people are like, oh, yeah, I will see that because that's ridiculous and funny. And and you're in on the joke, like you're invited to the party called Hot Tub Time Machine because it's so dumb. And so once people understood that, then it all worked. But then how do you get people to see it? Right. Because no one's going to admit that they're going to go see a movie called Hot Tub Time Machine. So hence they thought, well, maybe we should change the title so we don't have that barrier to entry. And Mary, I remember, I don't think it's my imagination, but I remember being in a meeting and I just remember her saying that she stood by the title, that was what was fun about it. And that, you know, she was going to take the risk to go to the market with that title and hope it worked. And I was like, that's super cool.
She rolled the dice. Yeah,
she rolled the dice. And she was the head of the studio. And she was like, I think that is the spirit of the movie. If you change the title, I'm not sure what you got. You know, and I think if there had been an alternative title that had been as compelling, then maybe that would have been a different story. But there wasn't one. And she wasn't willing to compromise, for another title that maybe would have attracted more audiences on its face, but would have just hurt the whole enterprise. And so Hot Tub is born.
It's kind of like the Weekend of Bernie's of its generation, because that's another like ridiculous. I mean, even more ridiculous is the sequel of Weekend of Bernie's, because at that point you're like, how long has Bobby been dead? kind of thing.
That's right.
You know,
Clark Duke. I don't know if you interviewed Clark Duke.
I'm not.
He made a really great film recently as a director, and he actually has a brilliant Weekend at Bernie's pitch, which someday I hope gets made.
Oh my God, seriously.
I won't spoil it. You can ask him about it. It's one of the most brilliant remake ideas I've ever heard for that.
Oh, movie. To remake, to go back and remake it? Okay.
Yeah, to like do another Weekend at Bernie's, but his approach to it is so brilliant. It's one of those ideas where you're like, well, only if you did that could you do it. right?
It's kind of never, like Cobra Kai.
Yeah, like Cobra Kai. They share sensibilities in terms of how it's approached. So you have to have Clark about it.
And you got, we'll definitely see if I can get him on the show, because you know what I find funny about, you know, as we've been talking about all the projects that you've done a lot of comedy in your filmography over the years. And I've worked with a lot of stand-up comics. I've worked with a lot of comedians and things like that. People don't realize how serious the creators of comedies take the work. You know, something like Hot Tub Time Machine, you can kind of just write off of like, oh, it's just a bunch of silly guys doing a bunch of silly stuff. But just as you're explaining it, there's a tone of seriousness behind, no, this is a midlife crisis film, and it's this and that. And yes, it's insane, and we understand it's insane, but this is why we're doing. So it's even when you go into the absurd, good comedies are taken seriously on the back end, behind the scenes. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, all the great comedies are really, you know, have really kind of the emotional journeys of all the characters are central to the story, right? Like in every single one, like Tootsie, Bridesmaids. Obviously all of Judd Apatow's work, like all the movies that I've done. Like, I know contrary to popular belief, comedy filmmakers are super interested in the story of the characters, you know, the characters, and so and what they're struggling with emotionally. We have to deal with it. It's just that, you know, the way we deal with it is through these kind of heightened, ridiculous, you know, circumstances. So if you were to look at deep into my filmography, there are movies where I didn't take that to heart in ways I should have, and the movie's not as good. Like, there are movies that I've done that I think are far, that it's like, okay, well, I'll just say, like, Hot Tub 2, I think, is far funnier. Like, pound for pound, it's actually a funnier movie, but it's not as good by virtue of the fact that you're not as engaged, you don't have as much rooting interest in the characters. What they're going through emotionally isn't as, you know, it doesn't have as much substance. And so after a while,
it's just jokes.
You struggle. Yes, it's jokes. And so, I have a deep love of that movie and it's lunacy. But if you're going to evaluate it in terms of like the character journeys, they're not quite as good. And so like to me, that that's central to every good movie, and comedy is no exception.
Yeah, I mean, you look at something like, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin. I mean, there's a lot of character in there. Yeah, there's lunacy and there's some fun stuff and there's great situations. But you're on the journey with this guy. You're on the journey with him. If not, it just, jokes get boring after a while. I mean, you could only do so many jokes and so much at a certain point.
You can name every single one. Groundhog Day is like, he has to learn not to be a selfish person. Like, we don't know why he's repeating the same day ever. There's no magic device that we're told exists. It just happens. but slowly but surely, we recognize that until he's not selfish, he's going to have to repeat every single day of his life. And, you know, Trading Places obviously is a great, you know, friendship story about class and race.
Oh, yeah. So many different layers on Trading Places or Coming to America. Or any of those early Eddie Murphy movies.
Yeah. Wedding Crashers, you know, like my favorite part of Wedding Crashers is when, Vince Vaughn's like, come on, we'll do one more. You know, who cares? It'll be fun. That's what we do. We're Wedding Crashers. You know, we're young. And then Owen Wilson's like, we're not that young. And right. Like, that was the whole movie for me. You know, I was like, oh, now I'm interested because, yes, the clock is ticking. Their lifestyle is is unsustainable, and so now I'm really in, right? They're living a life that is unsustainable, and they have to change, and they're either going to be forced into a change, or they're going to, you know, figure out how to make the change for themselves. And so like that's the movie, and that's why I just love it and think it's so brilliant. That Bridesmaids again is one of my favorites because it's you could see the marketing material after Hangover, you know, being similar to Hangover. But when you see the movie, it's about a woman in a quarter life crisis who feels like she's about to lose her best friend her best friend has a new best friend. And what does it feel like to be left behind? Like, that's to me the movie. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Comedies is a serious business. From working on them myself, I understand it's like, you know, timing and And that's what makes a great comedy, even something like Airplane, which is as absurd. And it's one of my favorite comedies of all time. There's still a character. You still care. I mean, and that's as absurd of a movie as you can pretty much get, the original.
Yeah. Airplane. And there is a moment, and I haven't seen that movie obviously in decades, but I think there is a moment where.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
If you can be so absurd that you're also engaged in something else, so then it doesn't have the same depth of character in the same way. But you're, again, like, I guess, Hot Tub, you're invited to this level of absurdity. You're invited to this party where things are so crazy and so absurd that it has its own satirical, it takes on its own satirical tone. Like, you're like, oh, all life is absurd, right? My life is absurd. Like, my life could be Airplane, you know, in any second. Right. Like all of our lives could really be that any second. And so then you become the protagonist in a way to me when I watch those movies. I'm like, oh, I'm the protagonist because all these, you know, like every single ridiculous thing that's happening moment to moment, moment after moment after moment is just reminding me of how absurd life is. And so I think that's a brilliant kind of comedy in its own right.
Right. I mean, I picked the wrong day to stop sniffing glue.
amazing.
I can't say I picked the wrong day to stop doing cocaine. Like it was just so. Oh, Lloyd Bridges. Oh, yeah. So brilliant. Incredible. Now, with all of these things we've been talking about, which has been a lot of comedies, your newest film, The Wheel, hilarious. No, I'm joking. So tell me about The Wheel and how and why at this stage in your career did you want to tell this kind of story?
Yeah, I mean, viewers, be warned, there's not a laugh for 1,000 miles in any direction.
There's no hot tub time machines. There's no ironic hitman.
No, there's nothing of that. There's only emotional distress.
right.
The opportunity, you know, I always wanted, you know, like one always wants to explore what else is possible, you know, what else I think I could do well. And this young producer, Josh Jason, who I work with on a commercial production, work within a commercial production company, brought me the script and I loved it. And the two actors that we found to play Albion Walker, Amber Midthunder and Taylor Gray, were extraordinary young people. And, you know, Josh had come up with financing, which was, you know, very, it's a micro indie. I mean, we spent nothing on that movie. The picture vehicles, my stepfather's Jeep, all the furnishings in the Airbnb that the young couple stays in are from my house. You know, we shot the movie with, I think there were 20 of us total, 25 of us total with cast, and we shot it in 18 days. And so I, you know, to do a story, you know, where, you know, I could explore dramatic arcs of characters was just something I wanted to see if I could do. And then also, you know, have the freedom to try and, create a visual world, that was super small, but super resonant. And it was COVID. We were one of the first COVID movies. I think our COVID plan like ended up in the white papers or whatever, because we were one of the first people, we were some of the first little crew to write it. And I could have never made that movie in any other time. You know, we went up to the summer camp, which was closed because of COVID, and we all quarantined. And then we, you know, we're just this little family up in the forest making this small and intimate little movie. And I was working with this young cinematographer, Bella Gonzalez, who's extraordinary. And we just, you know, it was just a wholly different kind of experience. Maybe one that I lost out on not having been a traditional film student, because I came out of theater. I didn't come out of film. So it felt very much like theater, or like doing a play, but I knew what to do with the camera now after all these years, or at least think I did. And so it was an extraordinary experience. And I was so super happy to make that movie.
Now, when is the movie coming out?
Movie just came out. Okay. Just this weekend. And so you can get it on all the platforms. It seems like it's getting good placement. You know, part of you agreeing to do this podcast, I'm sure will help us a great deal.
Oh, please. Thank
you.
So
all those listening, please go and see the movie.
Is it in theaters or is it going to be?
No, it's on streaming platforms.
Okay.
So Apple and Amazon and all the streaming platforms, you can go and watch it. Critics have been very nice to us, and that always feels good to me, especially since it's obviously commented often that, you know, in the reviews that I'm a comedy director, and like, you had no idea that I could do that. You know, I don't know that I knew I could do it either. I just wanted to try to do it. Right. And I think that's part of what we're supposed to be doing as filmmakers.
But I think as filmmakers too, I mean, we, you know, things that got, you know, got our juices flowing in our 20s is not what gets our juices flowing in our 40s. And, you know, you want to kind of, you know, you've been there, done that on some things. You want to, like, you know what? I want to kind of challenge myself. You know, I went off and made a feature in like 4 days and wow. stole the entire movie at Sundance while the festival was going on about filmmakers trying to sell their movie at Sundance. I'm like, I just want to go do this for fun. And if it fails, it fails, because it cost $3,000. It was no big deal. So, but
that's amazing. What's it called?
It's called On the Corner of Ego and Desire. And we shot it, you know, because it's exactly it. And it's the most absurd. Anything you've ever heard filmmakers saying is in this movie. Like the lunacy, the insanity, the delusion. I wanted to kind of make a love letter to independent filmmakers of how crazy we are and trying to get to, so I kind of just threw it all together and shot it, and it was scary. And to the point where my actors at the end were like, do you have anything? I'm like, I don't know. I haven't had time to look at anything. I've been transferring stuff, but I just don't know. Do you have a movie? I'm like, I think I have 70 some minutes. Let's hope. And we were lucky enough to make 73 minutes. I think it was the whole movie.
That's but amazing. Can I see, where can I see it?
Anyway, you can see it on Amazon. It's on Amazon right now. Yeah, it's on Freevee. It's on Freevee on Amazon, and you could rent it and all that stuff. I'll tell you about it after. But I just use that as an example. It's kind of like you just want to go out there and see what happens. And you could do it at that budget range. Like, you couldn't do that at a $40 or $50 million budget range with big stars. It's a little bit more pressure. So I'm imagining doing at this indie level, really micro budget, you get to go play, which must have been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was really freeing, and it was cool. And, you know, it had all the same problems, you know. Like,
exactly. But you have no money hose. So you have to figure it out.
Right. We had no money. And so, yes, we just had to figure out because it was COVID, we had no background. Right. So I had to create frames that felt full when there weren't people and things like that. There was a whole bunch of challenges, but all the challenges felt really familiar, mm-hmm. you know, and I, you know, to have Amber and Taylor, you know, and Bethany and Nelson Lee, the other two actors in the piece, be so game, you know, because it was so tiny, and we, you know, trying to create a world where these two couples clash and you know, are, you know, transformed by their interactions in ways that transform their lives, and do it in this very kind of, you know, intimate way was great challenge and was great fun. I'd like to do more of it.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions, ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker or screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
I would say that, and this is true of me even despite my lucky entrance, you know, the thing that you love and inspire by the most is the thing that you should... that you know more about than anyone else. Like, there's this thought that, well, you know, you're not in the business, so you don't know anything, right? But what you know, you don't know anything, and anything in quotes means all the things that, you know, are the complexities and nuance of being in the movie business. But what you do know is what your idea is. You have command of your idea, and you have command over what story you want to tell, and if you have the passion for it and the relentless, you know, energy to fight to make it happen, that's what your strength is. Like, you are as important a filmmaker, frankly, and in terms of being the author of your own story, as anyone else is. Like, so that's what you have to offer. You have to offer your creative sensibility and your perspective, right? I mean, I felt very I'm sure I was massively overconfident, but I felt very strongly about my perspective, you know, even Gross Point Blank, which we had a, you know, this glide path to making, I still had a very specific point of view. I was like, you know, this is a world in which, you know, if you like, my kind of fundamental idea for that was like, for John is like, well, if you could be all that you could be in America, you become an assassin. Like, because then you can be morally ambiguous, right? You can be amoral. You make a ton of money. You're your own boss. Like, what does America churn out as people? Like, will they churn out assassins who end up really lonely and isolated? Like, that's what, but you know, I'm not saying that's my perspective. Yes. You know, then my perspective was like, that is one version of what kind of human being comes out of American culture.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Right. And it was a very specific point of view. And so all the ridiculous hypocrisies of that and all the funny things that flow from that, like a really neurotic character and all those things, that was just something that I could express, you know, right. Simply express it to you today. And at that time, it was just a funny way to approach an anti-hero, right? So, you know, and I was convicted. So then when people said, oh, well, you know, he can only kill, this is a good example, I think, you know, he can only kill bad people. But that was like a rule that was trying to be imposed upon us. And we resisted it because we're like, no, that's only killing bad people. That's an American hero. Like he doesn't kill only bad people. He's a freelancer. He gets paid to kill people. He in fact is deliberately taking a position that he doesn't care what kind of person he's killing is. It's his job to kill them. And so, you know, that was something that we felt strongly about, that we fought for constantly, and that helped shape what the tone of the movie was. So I think that, you know, I would tell a young filmmaker to have confidence that that thing that is, you know, waking you up every day and driving you to go and get made is the thing that you are the authority of, and that you, and that's what you have to offer. And that's a strength. That's not, you know, you don't, you know, I think when you walk into rooms, you know, it's not, you sure you're asking people to pay attention and you're asking people to look at your work and embrace you. But at the same time, you're the one who has something to offer, something that we haven't seen before. And that's what keeps, you know, our creative industry happening.
Fantastic answers.
That would be my rant. If they make it this far in the podcast, they'll get, maybe you want to put that as a side clip, because they'll never get to this point in the podcast.
Not my friend, I've done 3.5. The record is 3.5 hours. So you're still way, you're good. You're good.
Awesome.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
The lesson that took me longest to learn. Patience.
Yes, mine.
Patience. You know, patience with myself, you know, patience even with my ideas, patience with everything, you know. And I'm even trying to be patient when I'm shooting, you know, like the first frame of any particular day I'm shooting, you know, that I did the very first setup of any given day, I have to remind myself to be patient. Like, it's not going to happen instantly, you know. I have to be patient. I have to see what happens in the frame. You know, we have to create the thing that we are here to create, and it's not just going to happen. And you can't be impatient. So I feel like you have to have patience on every level, whether it's shooting, whether it's a day shoot, or hoping your movie gets financed, or being patient that, you know, a good idea is going to come to you. You know, and you're not a complete failure who has no good ideas and should have never been in the movie business in the first place. Like, you need, so that I would say that's what I need to learn in life, and certainly in my career, and I'm getting better at it.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
I mean, you know, that's the question everyone's like, what? I mean, I'll just keep rattling off.
Just three that comes to mind right now at this moment.
Wow. Okay. They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Mm-hmm.
Sidney Pollack's first film. Harold and Maude.
Malapsky.
And wow, I mean, because I only get three, huh? Pulp Fiction.
All very good choices, sir. Steve, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you, brother. Congrats on all your success. And I wish you the best with your new film, The Wheel. And thank you for making us laugh over these years, man. I appreciate you, man. Thanks again.
Yeah, man. Thanks. My pleasure. And congratulations. This is a great podcast, and I'm glad that you're doing it.
I want to thank Steve so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Steve. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch his new film, The Wheel, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/222. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.